the City of Pittsburgh Chief Police. I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly. I order all those assembled to immediately disperse. You must leave the immediate vicinity. If you remain in this immediate vicinity, you will be in violation of the Pennsylvania Crimes Code. No matter what your purpose is, you must leave. If you do not disperse, you may be arrested and or subject to other police action. Other police action may include actual physical removal, the use of riot control agents and or less lethal munitions, which could cause risk of injury to those who remain.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. We're at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas. Today, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox is still on the road. I'm in St. Louis. Next week, I'll be in Sweden, so we won't have a new show next Sunday, but today's show is very special. Last week, I was in Pittsburgh, and I got tear gas. I got shot by what's called an LRAD, a long-range acoustic device. I was chased by the police, so I ended up going to the emergency room and being very ill this week. I don't know if it's Pittsburgh poisoning, the flu, or whatever. But anyway, I'm going to be in front of the White House on Monday, on October 5th, demanding that Obama listen to Voices of Reason, not his war council. But today we have a super-duper great show. We have activist actor Mike Farrell, so please stay tuned.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see that suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Our guest today is probably best known to most people as B.J. Honeycutt in the long-running hit series MASH, but I know Mike as a friend and activist.
Mike, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you, ma'am. Nice to be with you.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you. I haven't seen you for a long, long time. I know we used to run into each other semi-regularly in Los Angeles, but how are things going down there?
Well, you know, Los Angeles is a mixed bag, as is the case with a lot of cities. But we're doing okay. I'm used to seeing you, as you suggest, at all the demonstrations, all the anti-war demonstrations. So we haven't had as many lately.
Been all over the United States and the world working on this peace stuff. But before we get into talking about what you're doing now, I want to. Most people know you from your work on the series MASH. And when MASH first started, it seemed to be a little goofy. But as it went on over the long series, it seemed to get very overtly anti-war. And it seems that it was so overtly anti-war, that must have been a conscious decision. Is that correct?
Oh, sure. Actually, Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds and, of course, Alan Alda, who was the linchpin of the show, always felt that way. I think for the first couple of years, they were trying to kind of find their feet, if you will. The story indicates that after the first season, there was some question about whether the show would even continue. So they were, I suppose, trying to be somewhat careful. But as it went on, it became more and more an opportunity for those guys, and then those of us who joined the cast later, to express their views very forthrightly. And I think it's absolutely clear. There's no question the show was anti-war, and I think it was appreciated for that, and it still is today.
What year did the show start?
It first went on the air in 1972, I joined it in 1975.
Because I'm thinking that it was kind of overlapping with the whole Vietnam nightmare.
Oh, sure it was, yeah. Actually, you know, Robert Altman's motion picture came out in 69 or 70, really at the height of the opposition
right.
to the Vietnam War.
Right.
And Fox, which owned the rights to the book that it was based on, decided they wanted to make a television series out of it. And it's a blessing that they picked the people they did to do it, because they then ran with it and took advantage of the opportunity to make the show the kind of statement that it was.
And then when did it actually go off the air?
1983.
So it went off the air in a time where the American public started, you know, as far as my experience, going back into some kind of a non-war coma or something, where we thought that, you know, that nightmare was over and maybe we were past that in our consciousness, but that certainly wasn't the case.
Well, no, it certainly wasn't. You know, Ronald Reagan was president. I was involved at that point down in Central America, having been before that in Cambodia. So those of us who were in the anti-war movement, understood that there were still the war machine, if you will, was still very much active and very much in control of significant parts of the decision-making process in terms of foreign policy.
Well, this is interesting. What were you doing in Cambodia?
For many years, I've been the spokesperson and involved with an organization called Concern America, which is a refugee aid and development organization. And I was helpful to them here, and when they asked me to get more involved, I wanted to see their work. So the thing that was happening most dramatically at that moment was the exodus of the Khmer people from Cambodia into Thailand and other areas. But the big focus of the international concern about refugees was on the border of Thailand and Cambodia. So I went out there to look at the work that was being done and meet the people and see the effort that this organization and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was orchestrating. You know, I mean, it's one horror story after another, but at least these people were on some level getting some of their needs met, and that was actually the impetus for the beginning of my association in Central America, because the same organization began to work there with refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala during the terrible time down there.
Right. So have you been involved at all with the refugee crisis in the Middle East? I'm not even talking about the decades-long Palestinian crisis, but the one that was caused by the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, and now there's a horrible crisis in Pakistan and the tribal regions.
Yeah, the big thing that's going on, as I understand it, in Pakistan is in the, around the Swat Valley action that the Pakistani government or Pakistani military took. I haven't been out in that region in Pakistan or Afghanistan. I'm going in November to the Middle East again. That'll be my fourth time in the Middle East.
Okay.
And it, my first time in quite some time to see what is happening and what the hopes are or possibilities are for some a resolution of the terrible strife that's gone on there for so long.
What countries are you going to?
We start in Lebanon, go from there to Syria, to Jordan, to the West Bank, to Israel, to Egypt, and then into Gaza.
Well, definitely Syria and Jordan and Lebanon have definitely felt a strain in their infrastructure and social services because of the Palestinian and Iraqi crisis. I was in Jordan a couple of years ago. Jordan has absorbed, you know, had absorbed so many Palestinian refugees, and then they were up to over a million Iraqi refugees at that time that I was there. And, you know, we tend to think of the refugees as being marginalized or harmed or hurt by that, but it also puts a strain on the communities that the refugees flee to, doesn't it, in your experience?
Oh, of course, sure. I mean, you know, there's an international and a humanitarian requirement that we open our hearts and our arms to refugees who are people fleeing war and fleeing terror or even fleeing some cataclysmic natural occurrence. But it's hard sometimes to not to forget that the influx of a great number of refugees in a country, particularly a country that's relatively less developed than some of the great Western nations, that's a tremendous strain on the politics of that country, on the economy of that country, and on the culture of that country. So when I was in the Middle East, in Lebanon, the times I've been in Lebanon, Jordan, it was before the Iraq war, so therefore the Iraqi refugees were not an issue, but certainly the Palestinian refugees were a huge political influence in the country and are today.
There, I learned when I was there in Jordan that there's actually more Palestinians living there than Jordanians now.
Yeah, Jordan is a kind of a creature, like many of those countries, kind of a creature of political line drawing. And the Palestinians that were pushed out of what is now called the West Bank in as a result of the 67 war, many of them went to Jordan, and many of them went to Syria and on around the region. But yeah, there are huge numbers of Palestinians in Jordan, and in significant part, they've been incorporated into the political and cultural life there.
How can we, in contrast, the U.S. is the one that invaded Iraq and, you know, caused this crisis, but we've just absorbed very few
Iraqi refugees into our country when we could probably absorb them better than those poor countries surrounding Iraq? What can we do to exert more pressure on our government to accept more Iraqi refugees or make the process faster for them to be able to get here?
Yeah, that's the age-old question. We were certainly the aggressors in the Iraq situation, and we have a huge responsibility, not only as regards the refugees from that country, but also the people who are homeless and impoverished as a result of the war who are still in the country. But it was a tremendous, virtually a crime on the part of the Bush administration to wage this war and not be willing to open the gates to refugees from that were created by the war into this country. You ask how we can address that. I think it's primarily education. We have to educate the people of this country to the reality of the impact of that war and the reality of the needs of the people. I understand there's a significant effort now to repatriate some of the those who left the Iraq, but one doesn't know what the stability of that country is going to be like for the near future, so there may be some reluctance on some parts of those folks to go back. But I think these are the political questions and the humanitarian questions that are created by a stupid and illegal war like the Bush administration insisted on that country.
Well, I hope that when you get back from your fact-finding mission, you'll come back on the show and fill us in on what you're doing there. But I want to go back skip to another part of your work, and that's anti-death penalty work. And you've just, I saw on your website all the awards that you've won for your humanitarian work in that area also. And I think the United States, if I'm not mistaken, executes the third highest amount of prisoners. I think it's only behind China and Saudi Arabia. And first of all, I just really want to commend you for your work in that. I mean, we have to have prison reform, not just, anti-death penalty. Our prison system is way out of control in this country. Can I get your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you, first of all. Sure. Eliminating the use of the death penalty is a critical issue, but it is only a piece, as you suggest, of the necessary work that has to be done to rectify this so-called criminal justice system. We have the largest number of prisoners in the world in our prisons in this country, and huge numbers of them are people that don't belong there in the first place because of our whole craziness about drugs. But secondly, we have more mentally damaged people in our prisons than we have in our mental institutions. All of this is about politics, as you know, Cindy. Politicians who want to show how tough they are on crime, so they talk about being willing to kill, and they talk about locking people up and throwing away the key, and they talk about how tough they're going to be against lawbreakers. And the way it always manifests itself is in racial terms and in economic terms. So the prisons are full of minorities and poor people. So what we have to do, again, is the work that we're trying to do in my organization, Death Penalty Focus, to try to educate people to the fact that the system is broken. It is so vile and corrupted that it is an embarrassment and should be an embarrassment to every American. And that the elimination of the death penalty, in my view, is like taking the lid off the garbage can and requiring, once you take that lid off, people to look into this rotten, stinking, maggot-infested mess that's our so-called criminal justice system and begin to recognize the obligation we have as citizens of the wealthiest and ostensibly freest country in the world to treat our citizens in a way that that they deserve, and establish rehabilitation programs or habilitation programs and
right.
The necessary kinds of medical programs and the necessary kinds of educational programs for people so that they can get out of the syndrome of breaking the law in order to have a life.
Or maybe take some of the money we spend on that system every year and put it into early childhood education and other social support systems so it doesn't get as far as that in the first place.
No, that's quite right. And, you know, we've demonstrated here in California, where the governor keeps doing this dance about his budget, you know, we've got a multi-billion-dollar deficit in this country, and yet we're wasting millions of dollars every year by maintaining a death system that has been held in abeyance by the federal court for the last 3 years. It makes no sense economically, it makes no sense socially, it makes no sense on any level, and yet the politicians run in fear of being called soft on crime, so they're unwilling to do anything meaningful about either the death penalty or the conditions in our prisons.
How many countries in the world still have the death penalty?
How many countries still have it?
Right. I mean, are we like
of the 160 countries that are acknowledged in the world, about 130 of them have either given up the death system or don't use whatever death system they have. So we still have 35 or 40, depending on the number, countries that still implement the death system. And as you suggested earlier, the United States is one of the top offenders in that regard, China being the first, Saudi Arabia possibly being the second, Iran and Iraq up there in that list somewhere, but the United States is probably number three, as you've indicated.
You know, what is it? I mean, this isn't a procedural or a number question, but what is it about our country and this culture of death that we have where people aren't pressuring our politicians to do the right thing and end the death penalty? Because obviously it's not a deterrent. That's just another excuse that they use to keep us living in fear. But it seems to me like America has a profound culture of death.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think it's mostly fear, but to some degree confusion, but mostly fear. And politicians are very good, as you know, about leveraging people's fears into personal benefit. But there, part of it, I think, is an acceptance of something that's been going on in this country for a long time. Part of it is a belief that it works. There's a lot of ignorance about it. As you've suggested, there is no deterrent value to the death penalty, but people continue to make the argument that it does deter. People don't understand that it costs three times as much to kill somebody, to go through the process and kill somebody, as it would to keep somebody in prison for the rest of his or her natural life, if need be. People.
It's definitely a big business.
Oh, yeah, it's a very big business.
The prison industrial complex.
We have a prison industrial complex that is probably second to only our military industrial complex.
How many people do we have on death row currently in the United States?
On death row, we have about 3,300. Okay. California housing almost 700 of them, because we haven't killed very many people despite the fact that we're putting a lot of people on death row. And Texas, Texas, of course, is the major offender.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. But you and other people waged a heroic battle to try to save Stanley Tookie Williams. Many of these battles? Do we actually get, you know, clemency or stays of execution? Or, you know, are these just, like, battles that we have to wage because we have to, but are we successful very often with them?
Well, in fact, Cindy, we're beginning to be more and more successful. As you're aware, I'm sure, this year the state of New Mexico gave up the death penalty.
Yep. Yep.
2 years ago, New Jersey gave it up, joining the 13 states that didn't use the death penalty in this country. So we're moving in the right direction. More and more states are declaring moratoria. More and more states are taking a look, mostly, frankly, at the cost of it. They're beginning to understand that when they've got all the economic problems they have, it makes little sense to be wasting millions of dollars on a system that's, as we've discussed, is corrupt in so many ways. But also, you know, you have these kind of idiotic statements made recently by Justice Scalia and Thomas out of the Supreme Court about the case in Georgia of Troy Davis, about the fact that, according to Scalia, the constitutionality of whether or not one we can legally execute an innocent person has never been determined. Well, if that's the case, we damn well ought to determine it, it seems to me.
Well, that's one thing about the death penalty for me, among all the other things, is if one innocent person is executed, it's not worth it. And you and I both know that many, many, many innocent people have been executed. So to me, the anti-death penalty campaign is at least two-pronged. It's to fight for each individual person on death row, and it's to get the death penalty overturned, and if you have to, state by state by state.
Well, it'll have to be done state by state until and unless the United States Supreme Court rules again, as they did in 72, that it doesn't meet constitutional standards. It'll have to be done on a state-by-state basis. But, you know, you're quite right about the execution of an innocent. We have headlines all over the country now about Cameron Willingham in Texas, who was determined by a commission that studied the case to be an innocent person that Texas executed, Governor Perry executed in 2004. And just today, Governor Perry has fired three people on a commission that were in that were supposed to study this report and make a ruling on it as to whether or not Willingham was wrongfully executed. Instead of allowing that to happen, the governor fired three of the key people on the committee, and it's clearly out of embarrassment for being responsible for the execution of an innocent human being.
Well, one thing I think of, you said that education is so important. One thing that I think here in this country, and you know what has made a lot of people resonate with me, is that a lot of these arguments for so many people have been abstract. It's like they're not affected by it personally, so they don't you know, get the urgency or the moral issues. It's not just like executing innocent people, but when I hear that people who have been unjustly incarcerated for like 3 or 4 decades of their life, they finally get cleared by DNA evidence or something, and it's just like, oh well, 40 years of that person's life is gone, and nobody like tries to think, wow, what would my life be if I was illegally incarcerated for 40 years? You can't, those are things that you can't get back. Those are so many moments of your life and of what people take for granted that you'll never be able to get back.
That's quite right, and it's one of the reasons we're finding that some of the most valuable and most effective spokespeople against the death penalty are family members of people who have been victimized by violent crime, family members of people who have been murdered, who have now come to understand that there is no value to them or to their lost loved one in going through the process of executing the perpetrator or the presumed perpetrator. And the more that this movement grows, the murder victims' families that come out in favor of reconciliation instead of acting out of revenge, the more politicians pay attention. And so we're finding some really extraordinary progress being made as a result of the courage of murder victims' family members.
Well, you can count me as one of those, Mike, because I get people tell me all the time that George Bush should be executed or hung, you know, whatever, you know, put in front of a firing squad. And I say I'm not for the death penalty. That's not going to bring my son back. That won't bring millions of people back that he killed. But I'm for justice. I would like to see justice done.
Of course.
But not even taking the life of somebody, you know, that's so callous and irresponsible as George Bush.
Well, bless you for that, Cindy. And you are indeed the family member of a murder victim, as we know that illegal war was was an extraordinary blow to the morality of any morality that this country claims.
Well, and look, our country, I would say our country, I'm not a Saddam Hussein fan, But I would say we almost summarily executed him.
Oh, indeed.
And, you know, that to me was not the correct way to handle that situation either.
Well, I couldn't agree more. You know, when you look at the situation that happened that day with Saddam Hussein standing on the gallows and masked people shouting ugly epithets at him, the only person that handled himself with any dignity, as far as I could see, was the man who was about to die.
Right. And not being a fan of crime, you know, we're not saying that crime or murder is ever justified, but violence only begets more violence, and it just is a spiral that our nation really has to end soon, or, you know, I don't really have much hope for this country.
Well, bless you. You've been through a torturous experience and continue to be tortured by it, I know. And what you've done with the emotion that it's brought up for you and the education that it's provided for you is really to be commended. I just think it's quite extraordinary what you've done.
Well, thanks, Mike. Unfortunately, we're out of time. And first of all, I want you to tell Shelley hi for me.
Thank you.
And
I will.
Let's stay in better touch. And definitely when you come back from the Middle East, will you please come back on again?
I'll be happy to.
And can you tell my listeners, do you have a website?
Yeah, they can. Well, there are two. They can go to mikeferrell.org for anything that they want to know about me. And www.deathpenalty.org is the organization that I chair, Death Penalty Focus.
Well, Mike, thank you for using your talents to make the world a better place. I know that we all appreciate it. I know my listeners will appreciate it. So again, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today.
My pleasure, Cindy.
Thank
nice
you.
Talking to you.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me.
I'm Cindy Sheehan, and that was actor-activist Mike Ferrell. Next up, when we return from this short break, my very good friend from Dallas, Texas, Josh Smith, will be giving us a listener rant. Josh and I were running around Pittsburgh together last week. We had many adventures there in the trenches. Hang on, and we'll be right back.
If I please, the game of life is hard to play.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet. Those who send their children off to die in robber class wars. Those who lack proper health care. Those who are denied decent education. And those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hello, Cindy. This is Joshua Smith. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. I'm calling in with my rant this week to give you what I believe to be somewhat of my own State of the Nation address. I believe the state of our nation and of the world is at a never-before-seen crossroads. I now see an America that has been purposefully, systematically, and criminally driven into the final stages of social, moral, and economic bankruptcy. This overall condition has been a long time in its making. Over the past many decades, the people have slowly been compartmentalized within a prison of consumerism, debt, and taxation, acclimatized to an ever-growing number of policies of militarism, fascism, and control, and they have been desensitized to a widespread and grossly obvious corporate and political corruption. The congregated result of blind allegiance and participation, whether it be willing or unwilling, to these factors has built a framework of our own destruction. We are a nation that has succumbed to Stockholm Syndrome. We have ultimately and for the most part become sympathetic and dependent to our captors, despite their aggression, devastation, and thievery. In the last presidential election, the largest percentage of our nation pinned its ultimate survival on the open-ended and ambiguous campaign slogans of hope and change. These were then and are now hollow terms for hollow people. The people are simply and desperately searching for an answer that cannot be found within the current socio-economic political realm. You cannot find a simple or easy answer to a problem when the problem is of such a systemic and deeply rooted foundation. It is the very structure and practice of our current system that is our oppressor. We must be aware that our own government has begun to classify those who politically dissent or those that simply support our civil liberties as defined by the United States Constitution as terrorists, as self-radicalized homegrown extremists. So there is no longer a left versus right or Republican versus Democrat. It's the state versus you. We must all remember that this country was born by revolution against oppression. Our forefathers decided enough was enough. They decided that they themselves needed to be agents of change. The Declaration of Independence states that the government derives their powers from the consent of the governed, and whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and institute new government. It is our right, it is our duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for our future security. Long since the Declaration of Independence was written, a monolithically corrupt cartel of infrastructure, oil, insurance, media, and war has incrementally woven itself into the very fabric of our country. Day by day, week by week, month by month, and year by year, they have systematically put laws, policies, procedures into place to ultimately and primarily benefit only the wealthy and enslave the remainder. They have incrementally encroached upon the lives of Americans and sold us out. Profits before people at all cost. Long ago, this cartel joined forces and fortified itself within and around Wall Street and elite bankers. This cartel formulated a long-term plan in cooperation with overseas empires to rein in globalization. This new world order is the final stretch for the power brokers of the world to put absolute power into the hands of even fewer, ever increasing the gap between rich and poor, ever increasing their legacy of greed, collusion, and domination. The grand new chessboard of globalization will make more and more pawns of the people. As we saw at the recent G20 summit protest in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, those few that stood to peacefully assemble, to speak freely, and to petition our government for redress of grievances were terrorized, tear-gassed, beaten, attacked for the first time ever with highly powerful acoustic weapons, imprisoned, and fined. So, the status quo of America is go along to get along, pay up, and shut up. The robber class of America have unjustly seized control of the true national spirit of the American people. They wish to harvest the wealth of this world upon the backs of the people by driving economic cycles, by creating economic bubbles, and systematically imploding them by design and from behind the scenes. Enron-style accounting and Las Vegas-style Wall Street markets of speculation have and are still today playing God with our economy. Amidst our current crisis of war, bailouts, job loss, and dollar devaluation, the people of America are severely hurting, and we must turn this pain into purpose. We must become active now. We must become radioactive now. It is time for us to recognize, to understand, and speak truth to power without fear. I call on every American to prepare for a revolution in this country. The elements of this revolution must be to educate, to organize, and to resist. In the first aspect of education, we must A. stop believing and trusting in our current culture of corruption. B. research the concepts of oppression and class warfare. C. turn off mainstream corporate media and turn on alternative indie media. In the second aspect of organization, we must A. relentlessly spread our new awakening and information to family, friends, and coworkers. B. begin to form and join existing groups in true support of grassroots legislation and campaigns. C. realize that collectively we the people can be a powerful force. And then in the third aspect of resistance, I believe we must A. speak loudly, publicly, at every chance. Expose the oppressors in all forms and all venues possible. Be they public protest, internet videos, blogs, social networking. B. quit contributing to and perpetuating the current cancerous political system. Quit the Republican Party. Quit the Democratic Party. Become an independent, free-thinking human being. C. We must divest as much as possible from the market-driven slavery of oppressive corporations and divest from banks that feed on our labor through interest and usage charges of credit and finance. I say let the revolution begin. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh.
Chicago, just to sing. In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world. We are ready. Sit yourselves down, there's nothing for you here. Won't you please come
now in place of our Ask Cindy question, listener Aaron Peterson has a message for our friend Michael Moore, who needs to get a clue about Obama, in my opinion.
Dear Mr. Moore, in your praise of Barack Obama and your slam of the Democrats, why haven't you said anything about Barack Obama / George W. Bush's ongoing, continuing senseless war in Afghanistan? Cindy Sheehan, as well she should be doing, and as well we all should be doing, because it's such a stupid war, is adamantly and wholeheartedly opposed Barack's stupid, continuing war in Afghanistan. Your stance of standing beside and defending Barack Obama to myself, and I am hoping to many other American citizens, is somewhat troubling, baffling, and confusing. Yesterday, in a video speech, you were telling Barack Obama to not desert us now. While I'm asking the same thing about you, Mr. Moore, why are you supporting Barack Obama on health care when he is stealing health care from us by his spending close to $2 billion a day in the war in Afghanistan? Barack Obama's reasoning about Afghanistan is absurd, and it is insulting to anyone who has half a brain. Barack cannot have it both ways. He cannot hold the promise for life, health care for the American citizens in one hand, and be holding an M38 rifle for senseless killing, war, and death in the other hand. It is all more ongoing and endless madness and insanity. In order to bring about needed and proper health care in America, we have got to put an end to America's military's monstrous profiting off of senseless killing and war. It is that simple. And until we can put an end to America's senseless warmongering and war profiteering that sucks our lives and our money into the abyss, then we will never bring about universal health care for all in America. Barack Obama, with all due respect, Michael, is a joke. And if you continue to support him and what he is doing, whether it's health care or the war in Afghanistan, then you are going to begin to look like a fool. Don't let that happen to you, Mr. Moore. If you truly care about health care, Mr. Moore, and I sincerely know and believe that you do, why don't you say something to America about Barack's stupid Afghani war? Nobody in America is talking about Barack's war in Afghanistan and its reasoning for that war. Why? We should be talking about the war in Afghanistan, Mr. Moore, and not health care, because if we don't attempt and we do not try to stop the war in Afghanistan, then there won't be any health care in America. Sincerely, Aaron Peterson.
Thank you, Aaron. That's what the soapbox is all about. All of our opinions matter. Well, that's the show today. It was great, wasn't it? Our time together always goes by too quickly. Your soapbox assignment today is to spread the word about our great show at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We're going to close out the show with a part of a speech that I gave at the G20 last week. But before we do that, I'd like to thank my awesome guest, Mike Farrell, my awesome producer, Scott Cuddy, my awesome webmaster, Rich Bowser, my awesome assistant producer, Mikey, Rational Radio, and you, as always, for listening. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
So yesterday I was marching. Actually, yesterday I was just kind of walking down the street with about 2,000 of my friends.
Look, can I get a...
And all of a sudden, we were getting tear gassed. All of a sudden, we were getting these loud people telling us to stop. And I was like, wow, we live in the United Police States of America.
Can I get a job?
We need jobs.
Yeah.
We need education. We need housing. We don't need the United Police States of America. So before the fascists shot me with their sound cannon, they had an announcement to make. And we wrote an announcement for them. You guys have to help me. You have to repeat after me. You got it? You have to repeat after me. You got it?
Yeah. Can I get a job?
Tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Cheers.